Okay, by about 20 different clocks. We have 20 different times, but according to the computer clock, it's 7:30, so we're going to go ahead and get started. This is the Thursday November 2nd study session of the Mesa City Council. We are excusing Mayor Keno Hawker, who is out of the country on a sister city trip. And let me just note that he is paying for it himself, as he always does. We are also excusing Councilmember Summers, who is on a Homeland Security assignment to New Orleans. He will be back, I believe, the end of the week. We are at the end of the week, but at the weekend. So we have several items on our agenda. We're going to start with going over the council agenda for Monday, November 6th, and we have a revised agenda that we're looking at. It's the one that says revised 10/31/06, that we're all hopefully on the same page. And we'll start on page one. Anybody got anything there? Okay. Page two. Item number three is a recommendation for an acting council-appointed city auditor, and the recommendation is that the council appoint the current acting city auditor. We just have language like that to confuse everyone. I have a request that takes in items that are on pages 2 and 3, and I believe 4 as well, and it has to do with the liquor license approvals. Some of them are one-day events that happen year after year, and in the last couple of weeks, I've gotten a couple of contacts from citizens, not on these specific events, but on events that have taken place in the city, that there was a lot of noise, and they assumed that the city had issued a permit to these entities to have a party. City doesn't give party permits. It doesn't work like that. But there are certain events that take place where people get a liquor permit. And so I'm asking on a going forward basis if we could look, if somebody is applying for a second time around, did we have calls for service out to their event the previous year for noise complaints or other kinds of complaints? If we could get the nature of that on our report, I would appreciate it. Anything else on page two? Page 3, still on liquor licenses. Page 4, Tom, Councilmember Rawls.
Tom's fine.
Thank you.
I'm going to hold my questions until we get to item 3 on the agenda today, dealing with the item 6A. But okay. I will have some questions, but I also, I'm probably going to want to take it off the consent agenda, so if you take it off now, it'll probably make sure that it does get happened.
This is the police mobile command vehicle with the UASI Federal Homeland
Security
Grant.
Right, and since we're having a presentation later about the Homeland Security grants, I think I'll just incorporate it into that.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Anything else on page 4? All right, page 5. Page 6, we're still on grants. Councilmember Griswold.
On 6F, there's several different possibilities shown, alternatives. This is on consent. Are we taking the current one? Are we taking the one with the increased full cost? Are we taking the Phoenix model where people get their own barricades for parties?
Who's got the barricade one?
Vice Mayor, maybe I can speak to that. With reference to the barricade contract, the Trafficade service bid an $80 fee for the Blockwatch barricade. NES, which is the secondary contractor recommended, bid 25, which is the current fee. And we've been going back and forth over the last couple of days to try to ensure that NES will, in fact, service the block watch parties for the $25. We believe we can do that. We just want to raise the flag that if we had an issue with that type of service, we might want to come back and talk about the $80 fee for Trafficade. But right now, NES has told our staff that they will be able to accommodate that $25 fee and the service. So right now, we're fine. The $25 fee can stay as is. If we have a problem in the future, we'll probably come back and talk about it. But in the meantime, I think we're okay.
It's a great deal for the residents. As long as it's cost, full cost recovery, I have no problem. So I'll leave it on the consent.
Councilmember Rawls.
On the same item, I'm just curious whether there are national standards that dictate how many barricades and how far apart they have to be, because I'll just tell you, as I drive the streets of Mesa, I just find what appears to me to be an overwhelmingly excessive use of barricades for certain things. Now, if there are mandatory or at least recommended safety standards, I'd like to hear about them.
Yeah, Vice Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, there are national standards, there are local standards. There's a Phoenix Barricade Manual, which the City of Mesa and this council has adopted, that specifies the spacing, what types of signs to be used out on particular situations.
And how far away from the actual construction you have to begin
Correct.
Creating the barricades and stuff?
Taper distance based on the speed limit.
And I'm assuming that even though these aren't laws, the adoption of them puts us in a position where if we don't comply, there's at least a possibility of a negligence per se situation.
That's absolutely correct.
You agree, Debbie?
I might question the words negligence per se, but if we fall below the standard, obviously we are
right.
Exposing the city
right.
to additional liability.
Okay, I get a lot of complaints, not only my own experience, but I get a lot of complaints about people of just how much money we must be spending on all these barricades. And I just thought this was a good opportunity to put on the record why we do it. And thank you.
You're welcome.
I think our city attorney had a reputation for knowing more about street and highway cases than anybody in the attorney general's office when we got her to come over here. So good thing to get on the record that we don't want to get sued over this one. Councilmember Griswold.
I think in this area we may have saved some money in a barricade inspector, because I go around most streets and call on my cell phone if they're not down by 3:30 before commuting hour, and they've now called me the barricade inspector, because this same thing bugs me. When you start a mile and a half before a street begins to nail down, they have moved things. So if you see something, call.
I'll call you.
No, Glenn Gorky. I'll put him on speed dial. He does a very good job getting them done. So.
Now we have graffiti and barricades. All right. Anything else on page 6? Moving on to page 7. Councilmember Griswold.
On 6H, we're taking the excess water coming out of our well and doing it. Why do we need to do this? And what would happen if we don't do it? Spend this money.
This is an item that the project will improve the disposal of water generated with the startup of the well as the backup that we have there. Keith?
Vice Mayor, Councilmember Griswold, whenever you start up a potable water well,
can't use it.
The water is not of the quality that you can use, so it goes to waste. That water is what we do is we either dispose of it in a retention basin type scenario where we retain it and then dispose of it, or we discharge it into a drainage channel or something like that. So the purpose of the discharge is to get the water quality so it's acceptable to go into the potable water system. But the first kind of flush out of that well does not meet water quality standards.
What are we doing currently on this site?
We currently dump out into an area that ends up getting into the right-of-way, and it doesn't go away very well. So we're creating a retention basin on-site to dispose of this water. Plus, we're also putting in a flow metering device so we know how much water is going into there.
So it's currently backing up in the street. It's not just...
It's flooding the right-of-way area of Country or Arizona Avenue, and it creating a problem with nuisance water.
Because we mainly use these during the summer where things evaporate fairly quickly, so...
Still
causing a problem on this one.
We use our wells all year long.
Okay, great. Then it's well spent. Thank you.
Thank you. Items, anything on page 7? We're now moving into the introduction of the ordinances and setting November 20th, 2006 as the date for public hearing. Councilmember Rawls.
Just on items 6I, 6J, and 6K, we still have no backup, and I'm hopeful that we'll have some before Monday.
We do. In fact, you'll be receiving it tomorrow. We just got all of the bids this week. We've met with the city manager. We're ready to go forward, so you will receive all the information tomorrow.
So we'll have it over the weekend
yes.
to study, and it'll include the answers to the questions that we posed at the study session?
Yes, it will.
Okay, thank you.
Councilmember Griswold.
I'd like an explanation, if I could, on 7A on the construction tax credits. I understand we're just trying to be in sync with all the rest of the cities because it's required be uniform tax. Mm-hmm. If our legislature changed something, so we're coming up to code with it.
Yes.
Whether I agree with it or not, it doesn't matter. So.
Basically, that's the case.
Thank you.
Vice Mayor, Councilmember Griswold. This was a bill that went through the legislature. It actually affects state taxes, too. So We're just conforming to state tax and the other cities on this. It was approved by the Municipal Tax Code Commission, so we really don't have any kind of recourse on that. We fought it, and it's basically the argument was it's a tax on top of a tax. Because
basically the fees you pay in development fees, and then those are deducted off your
gross income.
Gross income.
Right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Roger. I actually serve on the Municipal Tax Code Commission, and when the legislature changes the law, it isn't like we have a whole lot of choice in changing it. Thank you. Anything on page 8? We're still on introduction of ordinances. Councilmember Griswold.
7C and D are both just examples. There's a lot of annexing going on, people wanting city services out in the county islands, and, you know, we're not putting pressure. In fact, we're sometimes keeping them from joining because of our rules, but these are both probably good projects to join the city. And I had a question, or just a comment on 7F. This is the old Holiday Inn being torn down, brand new Holiday Inn being built down by Wrecker and Main Street and new casitas behind it. A lot of that area, very old part of Mesa on Main Street, is now being revitalized with private enterprise and private dollars. If you drive down there, it's changing rapidly, so that's a very good sign.
Thank you. Anything else on page 8? Page 9, we're still on introduction of ordinances. These are all coming out of that planning and zoning meeting that lasted till after midnight, I believe. Moving on to page 10, anything there? Still on introductions. Page 11, still introductions. John.
Yeah.
Wait. Page 12, John.
Mr. Wesley. Council, just wanted to point out on item 7Q, it's Z0688 or 86, which is for the former Mesa Highlands, now Stonebridge development on Ellsworth and Elliott. Part of this includes a development agreement. We are working diligently with the developer on this. Hope to have them together on the November 20th meeting. There's a chance that this will be delayed if that development agreement is not yet ready. So just wanted to give you a heads up on that.
And I noticed that there were 13 public hearings on this. That has to set an all-time high. Councilmember Griswold.
Just a comment on that process. It was very refreshing and interesting. The first meeting, they had sort of like a sketch, and rather than spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on a drawing, when the neighbors weigh in it, they're not going to change it anyhow. Every meeting I went to, it had changed a little bit from what the neighbors said. And by the time it came out, I went to meetings with 80 angry people, and by the time it came to planning and zoning, there was no objections, and people were fairly satisfied. And that's hard to do on 720 acres, and they're leaving 300 acres of it as desert, which is pretty unusual. I had a question on 7R. The backup material says we're changing it from $1.50 to $16.50. I think it's supposed to be $15, isn't it?
Yeah, $1.50 increase, I think.
We're increasing it by $1.50, excuse me.
Okay. I was just reading, maybe I misread it. And on 7S, just the background material, this is the condition of sales utilities are certain exceptions. This would be additional revenue we'd receive no matter what. We're not receiving it now. This is county islands it has to do with and issuing utilities. Am I misreading that? Or?
Vice Mayor, excuse me, Councilmember Griswold, this is a proposal to modify one of the exceptions, 23C, in essence back to what the language read prior to July when it was last changed. Excuse me. This pertains to properties located outside the city limits that are requesting water and or wastewater service. I'm not sure I understand exactly your question on revenues, though.
Just reading through, it sounded like it was going to cost us money, but actually this is additional revenue we're not getting now. Am I correct, or am I just misreading it?
I'm not sure that there's a fiscal impact to this modification. Certainly if this would grant the utility committee and then ultimately the city council with the authority that you previously had to modify the conditions and the terms for the sale of water and wastewater. in doing so, it's possible that if you were to waive such things as maybe the fees or a requirement for street improvement or something of that nature, that it would ultimately have an impact on the general fund. Eventually, the money would come from another source instead of from that development.
Okay, it just says reduced utility service fees in option one, which we're not getting now. So it's ultimately, I wouldn't have a problem if ultimately it was in there. Right now, it's new money we're not getting. So I just wondered on that.
Okay.
And Councilmember Griswold, maybe I can help a little bit. This is changing the code just back to what it was before July. At that point, council had the discretion to waive certain conditions in granting individuals coming to the utility committee and ultimately the council that are outside the city seeking utility service, such as water, wastewater. This places the discretion back into the code. It will ultimately be up to the utility committee and the city council to decide whether to waive or modify some of those fees and conditions. So at that point, with individual cases, if the council waives or modifies fees and conditions, it could have a fiscal impact. Changing the code has no fiscal impact on the city at this point.
Probably my problem was the tenor or the wording of the background information. And
okay. That
was just, it made it sound like it's a direct loss right now rather than ultimately we could, if they joined. Right now we just get extra revenue. Ultimately if they joined, we could do. So this is dealing with usually properties that can't join because of our own rules.
When I looked at this, what I noticed was that it was an inadvertent change that had taken place
right.
when we changed the code back in July. We're fixing that. It allows the council to have more, back to having the discretion that we had before, which I think is appropriate. I did think that there were some issues with the way the report was written because having option one and option two, rather than saying this is the recommended direction, and then sometimes we get that recommended direction, and then it says council alternatives, which would probably be the more easily understood way of going on this report. I had a note to myself that it was the report was confusing in that way, but I think it's appropriate for us to change it back to the way it was before, which gave this council discretion. Councilmember Jones.
And Terry, thank you. Our last utility committee meeting, we were obviously in a position where we could do nothing when logic said we needed to. So I thank you for taking care of this.
I agree with that.
Yes, sir.
And I agreed with the proposal, not just the wording of the background. That was my problem. And if I may, 8A, I just had a question on it.
Sure, go ahead.
How many protest letters have we received? It was.
And we're just setting the date for right. December 4th right now. So this is setting the date for the public hearing on the Town Center Improvement District.
Yeah. Vice Mayor, Councilmember Griswold, none to date. What will happen is that the Vice Mayor indicates you set the hearing date at that point. Once the hearing date is, then that sets the process in motion. We'll send out letters, assuming Council approves setting the hearing date on Tuesday the 7th, and that starts the process.
Yeah. Thank you.
Councilmember.
On item 8A, it may be a linguistic issue, but it talks about that the district is going to provide enhanced municipal services. Municipal services to me means services that are provided by the city. What is meant by that phrase in this context?
Vice Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, there really aren't any enhanced city of Mesa municipal services. The Mesa Downtown Association will provide additional cleanup of the town center area. They do a little additional maintenance on the landscaping. Those types of things is what the money's used for.
Right, and that's my understanding. I just think that the language choice, both here on the agenda and in the backup material, that talks about enhanced municipal services, is misleading, because it sounds like we're going to be doing something more, and we're not. That's the whole idea.
Correct, Councilmember Rawls, and we'll look at that wording.
Okay.
And can you find out, please, whether or not by law we have to post it that way? Because if not,
we'll check it. I know in other public improvement districts, that is the way it's phrased, that they are providing the city provides a base level service and they provide the increment on top of that. So it may come from the statute itself.
Again,
but we'll check.
If that's required, fine. I just
check on
it's a misnomer, but it may be a required misnomer.
Vice Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, it was really, I think, how the initial resolution was set up back in 1985 when they started the district. So that was the wording, I think, used in the initial resolution, and that's why it's reflected away. State statute is pretty general as far as these improvement districts.
Mr.
Vice Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, although on this one, state statute is enhanced municipal improvement districts, so they're using this part of state statute, I believe, that specifically refers to it as enhanced municipal services.
If it's required, leave it. If it's not, I'd like to see a change.
Thank you. Councilmember Whelan.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. Debbie, do I have a conflict in just setting the hearing?
Councilmember Whelan, you would.
So we need to call it.
Let's take it off consent.
That would be Keno, myself, and Kyle.
Kyle, you have a...
You own property in the district or...
But the property would not be subject to this, I don't believe. I'll check into that and see.
In the past, you've been conflicted, haven't you?
No, that was when they were, but it's when they were talking about whether to expand, change...
The redevelopment area.
Redevelopment area.
Not the...
Not town center. So it's just Keno and I?
I believe so, but I'll check to make sure historically what Councilmember Jones has done, but I don't recall that.
Thank you.
And Councilmember Summers will be back, so we will have four people available, even if Councilmember Jones is conflicted on that. But if we had too many people conflicted, then the law would kick in that all conflicts are declared and we still participate. Okay, anything else on page 12? Moving on to page 13, Councilmember Rawls.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. On item 8C, I have, one question and one comment. Question is, this is a change of a fee, and I'm just curious as to whether this has gone through any of the three committees that would deal, that I can envision dealing with this, either the Finance Committee, the Transportation Committee, since it deals with the airport, or the General Development Committee.
Vice Mayor Walters, Council Member Rawls, no, it has not.
Was there a reason why not?
It was...
Vice Mayor, Council Member Rawls, no particular reason at all. This seemed to be pretty focused on two companies and bringing Sabina Air in. I guess we just never thought about sharing it with the committee.
Well, let me ask, and that gets to my question, I guess, is this part of whatever deal we may have struck with Sabina Air, or are they coming anyway?
They're coming anyway. They had requested that we match the tie-down fees that they're currently paying at Scottsdale, but they were made aware that this would have to come before the City Council for consideration. So they're aware that there's a, it could change or it could not, depending upon Council's wish.
I guess, and that also got me to my comment, and under the fiscal impact part of the report, it says, given the recent announcement by Sabina Airline, et cetera, to relocate, the annual net revenue effect on the airport for this ordinance change or this fee change is, but the additional fuel flowage fee, et cetera, isn't as a result of this change. This is actually a loss of revenue.
It is a loss of revenue in terms of the tie-down fees per se. If you just look at the cut, but on the other hand, with Sabina coming in, we're actually going to be leasing 40 tie-downs that we're not currently leasing. So the net result of it, even though you're taking a loss on the reduction, you're actually going to be making more revenue because you've now leased out 40 tie-downs that are currently vacant.
Then we're back to the chicken or the egg, whichever comes first. Is the reduction of this fee a condition for Sabina to come?
No, it is not.
Have they signed their documents that indicates that they're coming anyway?
Yes.
And they have requested us to do this?
Yes.
I'm not saying it's not a good thing to do it, but when somebody has made a commitment to come, and they're bound to come, trying to describe this action as a revenue enhancement because they're coming when they're already coming, to me is misleading. And so I don't know whether it should go through a committee or not. My sense is that all fees should go through one of the committees, but I personally don't have a problem with reducing it. I thought that the fiscal impact analysis was misleading.
Councilmember Griswold.
Just to put it in perspective, we have a plethora of tie downs, and we have a shortage of the hangars. So this is empty space. It's not being leased. So it is, in one sense, additional income. But you're right. It is coming, whether you're not or not. So I can see you're on the wording. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with it. But yet, right, some of the wording I would like to make sure that we, you know, are a little clearer on.
I think that the other thing that this gets to is a point that I've been talking about to staff for a while, which is I don't think we have a consistent policy about what goes to a committee and what doesn't. And so it leaves staff people in this awkward place where do we take it to a committee? Do we not take it to a committee? Should every fee discussion go to the Finance Committee, for instance? Or Tom said, well, it could have gone to any one of three committees.
Right.
But I think we need some clarity on that, and I think it's up to us as council members to give that clarity. So my suggestion is that we put this on just this discussion of where things should go, what committees they should go to, on a study session agenda so that we can give some clarity to staff, because nothing here was done was wrong. Everything is fine, and the report, as Tom pointed out, has some issues in terms of what it's...
claiming.
And you know, there are those of us who go through these things, and we're always editing. We edit everybody's work as we're looking at these, and so okay. We point out discrepancies. but that doesn't mean that the underlying issue is something we don't like. But my thought is here that staff doesn't have clarity from council on what should go to committees and what shouldn't. I think that any fee like this should go through the Finance Committee ahead of time. That's just my opinion, but I think council needs to give some direction on that to staff, and we don't have that as policy right now. I don't have a problem with moving forward on this, but I think that we need to give future direction. Council Member Ross.
And if I can clarify, I have no problem moving forward with this increase, but I do agree with the Vice Mayor that all fee increases or all fee changes ought to go through the Finance Committee. That's why we have that committee, so that we can get a more in-depth look at the financial issues. So, and secondly, I'm not opposed to this fee reduction, and I think it will actually help generate long-term revenue as additional companies see that if they bring X number of planes, they get a reduction in the tie-down fee. Volume purchasing is basically what we're talking about here, and I think it's a good idea to have it. My objection was to the implication that this change was somehow responsible for Sabina coming. And we've said that enough, so thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
And speaking of editing everything, I appreciate Council Member Rawls editing me. Fee changes should come, not just fee increases. Next thing, I'm going to be saying something about people in Iraq or something. Who knows? Okay. Item three. No. Okay, page 13. Anything else on page 13? Council Member Rawls.
On item 8H.
Yes.
Which is the use of eminent domain to condemn, potentially condemn up to 21 parcels of property for a road improvement. Let me start by saying I have no objections to the use of eminent domain for these kinds of purposes. However, the resolution that we're adopting has some fairly strong language in them that says certain real property here and described as necessary. It is necessary that fee simple title of certain real property be vested. Is deemed necessary and essential. It is necessary for the city. It is necessary for the city. And what I have is a city council report and some maps. The maps show me what places, if I have a magnifying glass, I can actually read some of them. But there's nothing in here that tells me why it's necessary or why it's reasonable. And I'm being asked to exercise one of the most awesome powers that the government has, that is the taking private property, and I need more than what's in this report, because this report just basically has, and I've read it fairly carefully, a conclusory paragraph that says, these reasonably necessary things are necessary, but it doesn't tell me why they're necessary. I don't have a feel for the project. Maybe now's not the time. Maybe it needs to be some other time, but if I'm gonna vote for eminent domain, I've got to have more than a conclusory statement in a staff report.
And Craig, I appreciate your coming up. I had a notice on this that I wanted a status report on it, so maybe you can answer both things.
Vice Mayor Alders, Councilmember Rawls, can you rephrase your question? There, you mentioned
my question is, give me some facts that tell that would allow me to vote that says this is reasonable and or necessary and essential, I think is the phrase in the resolution. And I don't have that.
Thank you. The we're down to 21 parcels. We're down to about 15, a number of 6-8 weeks ago. SRP came in with a number of additional easements that were required. So we had to add from the minimum, well, not minimum, we're down to about 14 of parcels we're negotiating on. Most of these were landscaping issues, changing the signs, moving walls back on an apartment complex. In order to meet the schedule for this around January, February, March, we need to ask for authority to start the process. It doesn't mean we're going to use it. Hopefully, historically, we have rarely gone to court on an eminent domain issue. We resolve and negotiate the issues, you know, before that time. But in order to meet the schedule, especially for Keith and answer to SRP, for SRP to relocate utilities, we cannot do it on a right of entry. You either have to have an immediate possession or a closed escrow.
Craig, may I recommend that you do a revised council report that answers the questions that Councilmember Rawls had so that we have in writing what makes this
sure
essential. I think that's important.
Right, and if I can clarify, I understand the timing issue. What I don't have is why that particular strip or piece of property on that particular piece of property on that lot is necessary and essential for the project. So I need some facts that says the road's going to go here, or there's going to be a stoplight right in the middle of that. So I need to know why each one of these 21 pieces.
And we have that information.
I know you have it. But you don't get to vote. I have to vote, so I need it.
Councilmember Rawls,
does that make sense?
We'll work with Craig. Okay. We'll make sure the council report is revised to meet your needs.
And please understand, this is not a philosophical objection. This is perfectly appropriate use of eminent domain. I'm being asked to do something that is really powerful, and I need a higher level of proof before I vote that way.
We can get the information.
Okay, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Councilmember Whalen, you might not want to leave yet. Councilmember Whalen.
Along that same line, I'd like a list of property owners who were exercising. It appears that a physician that I go to is one of the properties that's being taken. I want to make sure I don't have any customers there. I do have some in the area. And if we could just have a list of the property owners, it would help me make that decision.
And we'll get that to you, Phil.
Thank you. Councilmember Jones.
I think it would probably be appropriate, too, because eminent domain is such a touchy subject that if we could have some kind of language that people understand, this use of eminent domain is because it's for the roadway, for the factors of safety and stuff. But when people think of eminent domain, they think of just taking. You need to understand eminent domain is a resolution in court for the value of that property. Both parties may agree it's necessary for the project. They just can't agree on the price. And that's typically why eminent domain would be used in a situation as this. But the typical general public doesn't understand that. And for the benefit not just of us and any backlash, but people need to understand that process. And I think it would be good to have that included, at least briefly explained in the report for the record.
And let me just tag on to that. It's not just price. We might agree on a price. It's timing. Especially when you have these large corporations, and I noticed that several of them, it was a timing issue. At least that's what it seemed to indicate in the notes that we had there.
Are you dealing with attorneys? Oh.
Tom, he's going to get you somehow today. So I think that would be important as well. Councilmember Griswold, did you have something on this?
No, just I agree with Councilmember Jones that, eminent domain means you give your best value, we give the best value, and the courts decide, and juries decide what's the best value for that piece of land. But I also agree with Councilor Rawls. I would like to know why this road needs to be widened, and at least 20 pieces of property need to go. Is this going to be done in 10 years, or is it supposed to be done in 3? I know the log jam it creates right here for our traffic during commuting hour. This needs to be done, but I'd like that stated somewhere in there.
I think it's in this year's CIP, isn't it?
You know, Council, I guess we can get more specific. I think that we do talk about six traffic lanes are needed, yeah. Gilbert Road from Decatur to the Consolidated Canal on University. If the question is today the width of the street is X and the width of the street needs to be Y in order to accommodate the six lanes, we can certainly do that. We do talk about the fact that it is scheduled to begin the first quarter of 2007, so we understand that there's a timing issue there. I think what I think I hear from the council, because I think the project's being described as a six traffic lanes with bike lanes and landscaping and dual turn left lanes, is it sounds like what we need to describe is the fact that the current geometry is more restrictive than what is needed, and tell you that we need an additional, I'm not sure how many feet it is, but that's what we need to probably add into the components of the description. We can do that.
And I think that there's, I think what Councilmember Rawls is referring to is individual parcels.
Right.
On parcel 27, we need a landscape easement. On parcel 26, we need this. On parcel 25, that's what he's asking about.
You can do that.
Keith?
Vice Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, what we will do is we will give you a list for each individual parcel and identify why we need an easement or right of way. Majority of them are to accommodate a utility or to improve the driveway to tie back into existing improvements on site. So that's the majority of what's needed here on this particular project.
I think the council is, understandably queasy any time the term eminent domain comes up, because that conjures up one image in everybody's mind, and that is not the appropriate image here.
If I could, and first of all, I agree with what Kyle and Rex said, except eminent domain isn't simply about price. It's also about the ultimate taking. Well, but I just like, I don't want to argue about how wide the street is. I don't have the expertise to say that it should be 58 feet rather than 62. I just need a map that shows that the 62 encroaches upon this piece of property, and that's why we need it. Or the easement is going to run along here, and that's why we need that parcel. That's all. Just, I need evidence rather than conclusions in order to vote to exercise my power of eminent domain.
And Councilmember Whelan has pointed out he needs names, as we all do, to make sure we don't have conflicts. Councilmember Whelan.
And one other thing I thought about, as this project was coming forward, there was a plan to do Gilbert Road all the way north. That's been placed on hold. If we're not explaining the fact that we're just doing the intersection, there will be lots of folks north of this location thinking we're doing the whole roadway, too. And I don't believe that's anywhere in the next 5 years.
Vice Mayor, Councilmember Whelan, that's correct. It's not in our current plan as far as going north of this point. We held a public meeting on this project and actually mailed to an extended area just to inform them of that, so everybody was clear as to what the extent of the project is.
And why we're doing the intersection is we've got studies that show that if you increase the size of the intersection to where cars can at least merge, you will increase traffic flow down the roadway, and we've done that in several intersections throughout the city.
Vice Mayor, Councilmember Whelan, that's correct. Transportation has actually recently done some new intersection studies that show, obviously, the intersection with the signals controls the progression of traffic on these major arterials. By carrying the third lane through far enough distance, you can increase the capacity on the roadways and maybe avoid having to do all of the roadway and just do some of the intersections.
And I can't remember, is the continued widening of Gilbert Road to McKellips anywhere in our plans?
Councilmember Whelan, I believe it's in our transportation plan, but it's not in our current CIP plan nor in the RTP plan.
Thank you.
And this widening has been, we've been working on this for some time. If people go past that intersection, they'll notice that the Garcia's restaurant has moved back. There's a new Garcia's restaurant there. This is not a new project. This is one we've been working on for some time. Keith, does the widening go all the way up to the bridge?
Councilmember or Vice Mayor Walters, yes. We start right at the bridge and go north up through the intersection of University, approximately about 1,000 feet, and then taper back. And on University, we're also going back to the bridge. As Council may remember, we've already widened those bridges previously to account for this future roadway improvements.
Thank you. Thanks for all the time on this. Really appreciate it. Just a note that on page 13 we have, and is it page 13 and 14? Yes, on page 13 and 14 we have a couple of alley abandonments, neighbors that have gotten together and have worked with our folks to their trash pickup is no longer in the alleys, and I just wanted to say some nice things about those neighborhoods that are working together to make their neighborhoods better. We really appreciate that. Councilmember Whalen.
We're on 14?
We are. Just turning the page.
On 8J, Mr. Brady, have we resolved the issues that we were concerned about?
Yes, I believe I was told that we have. I think we've come to an agreement on everything. And I also believe that there is, was the public hearing already? Is it tonight? There's a public hearing out of the neighborhood about the fact that the SRP will be constructing this substation next to their neighborhood.
And that starts within the next couple of months?
It starts January. I think their goal is to move forward in January.
And that was a high voltage.
It's a 500 kV, right, and a 220.
Yes, Tom, sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I need to go back to 8H for just a minute.
Sure.
The letter that was sent out on October 27th, I thought, was missing a key component just by prayer. It didn't have the time of the meeting. It talked 8H, the eminent domain issue. We sent out a letter on October 27th to all the people explaining that we're going to have a meeting on November 6th to take up this eminent domain. And it says where, and it says the date, but it doesn't provide a time. And I think we need to be a little more careful than that when we give public notices.
We need to make sure those property owners know the time of the meeting. I see Christine nodding her head. They're going to take care of that. Thank you for pointing it out, Tom.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on to page 14. Item 8K is, these are our intergovernmental agreements for grants from the, 18%? 12%. 12% money. These are grants that are coming from the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community, going to Mesa Public Schools, City of Mesa for the Mesa Arts Center and the Mesa Public Library. I'm not pulling it off. I just want to note that we really need to thank the people in the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community who are our neighbors for sharing this with us. They get many, many applications for these grants, and we are very appreciative of the fact that they chose to award some of them here in the City of Mesa. Very kind of them. Item 8M, I am advised that we have an agreement. Debbie, do you want to tell everybody about that?
Yes, thank you, Vice Mayor. We have, pursuant to the Council's direction on Monday, we continue negotiations with the entities, and we have reached an agreement. They have signed the development agreement, so at this point, we're simply waiting for Council approval of the development agreement and as well as the zoning.
Given that, can we put both of these on the consent agenda tied together? If either one gets pulled off the consent agenda, then the other one will get pulled off the consent agenda. Can I get agreement from the council on that? Is that okay? Okay, so let's put those on the consent agenda. If either one gets pulled, we'll just make note to the city clerk. If one gets pulled, the other one does too.
What's the other one?
The other one is 9L.
And, Vice Mayor, if I might add, I apologize. The copy that is in your packet is unsigned, but it's identical to the agreement that was signed.
We'll get your copy.
Okay. So the copy you have is the latest version.
Councilmember Rawls.
And it's been signed by all three entities? not just two?
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay. Moving right along. Anything else on page 14? Page 15. These are ordinances that we're going to vote on. I'd like to pull item 9A, please. B was B and C are tied together. I think they're okay, though. Any questions on that? On page 16, on item 9H, do we have any word on that legal protest?
Vice Mayor, we have discussed this with the person who submitted the legal protest. They're aware of the changes that have been made to the site plan that are things that they asked for, but at this point they have not indicated that they are going to remove their legal protest. We're still waiting to see if that happens. And I will go ahead and comment that you have a revised site plan in front of you this morning that is different than what was in your packet that moves the wall back on the east property line. It's one of those negotiated items.
And there has been a lot of work that has been done on this, working with the concerns of this property owner and just a reminder that because of the legal protest, we need a three-quarters vote on this, which would require six affirmative votes to pass it.
If there's that many here.
Are you expecting to be gone?
No, I mean, Keno is...
Keno's gone, but Scott's back, Dubeck.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, so you're exactly right.
It would have to be everybody.
Yeah, it would have to be everybody. That's correct. Okay. Moving on, anything else on that page? On page 17, we have more zoning cases. And 9L, we're putting on consent. Page 18, anything there? Okay, let's move back to the pink agenda. And we're going to hear a presentation and discuss and provide direction on fire prevention fee model that is coming to us from the fire committee.
Vice Mayor, members of the council, good morning. We have a couple items to present for you this morning. We're starting with the fire prevention service level presentation. As you may recall, at a previous council meeting, we were charged with developing a plan to improve our fire prevention services, including a full cost recovery model that will go along with that. Since then, we have done a considerable amount of staff work and research, put together a draft plan, and met on October 16th with the fire committee. We did receive some direction and input from the committee, made those adjustments, and then we were given approval to proceed to this study session to present our plan to you. We're also here to accept some further direction if necessary, but ultimately we're looking for approval of the plan so that we can proceed with implementation. With me this morning is Chief Puckett and Chief Horn from our Fire Prevention Division, and they're going to walk you through the plan.
Vice Mayor, Council, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to present here. The plan, the model we're going to present, we are very confident is going to really enhance the service levels of our Fire Prevention Bureau per your request, and as a result of that, obviously enhance the safety of our community. Chief Beck gave the historical perspective in terms of how we got to where we are today, and so with that, I will go ahead and get into our presentation. And basically what we'd like to cover here today is give an overview of the cost recovery program. Again, this really isn't a presentation on cost recovery. It's a presentation on enhancing our fire services to our community. But in order to do that, we've got to talk about how we're going to pay for that. So we'll spend some considerable time on that. It's also, as Chief Beck mentioned, is an expanded program per council's request. During those budget presentations, when the discussion about eliminating fire prevention services was discussed, you expressed a real concern. Not only do you not want to eliminate fire prevention services, but many of you expressed an interest to actually enhance it. So that's the program we're going to present here today. And again, also receive approval and direction from this council in terms of what you feel our next steps should be. With that, I'd like to start by talking about current staffing levels. Currently, we have six inspectors, three fire prevention assistants, two administrative support assistants, one supervisor, and one program assistant. Total cost of that is $906,000. As a result of that, the service level is we get about 32% of our high and medium risk businesses inspected annually. And we'll talk a little bit more about the service levels further on in the presentation. The proposed additional staffing that we're going to present to you today would add nine inspectors, two supervisors, two admin support assistants, and two part-time positions for financing and accounting. Again, when we started presenting this model, we tried to reach out to see who else does this impact within the city. We found that the model that we're presenting impacts finance and accounting. They said in order to support that model, if it's implemented, we would need two part-time positions, so we included that in our presentation. And you see the total cost there for that. When we presented previously, one of the areas of great discussion with council was how do you define high risk, medium risk, and low risk occupancies. Put this slide in here, obviously a bad slide for presentation purposes, but we want to put that in there to show you that we have a definition now for high risk businesses. And you can read that at your leisure. For presentation purposes, I've broken that definition down to kind of further define what a high risk business is. And basically a high risk business would be defined because of the type of business it is, the quantity of material stored there, the quantity of materials used, if they use hazardous materials, store hazardous materials. Obviously, that would make them a high-risk business. Additional factors would be the quality of materials that are handled, the processes that are performed there. Certain businesses, just by the nature of the process they perform, are very hazardous to our community. The occupancy, if there's a large number of people that gather there, obviously that's a concern for us. And the size and complexity of the structure would be defined as a high-risk business. A couple examples would be large assembly buildings, adult and child care facilities, woodworking businesses, and spray finishing businesses. A few more examples would be semiconductor manufacturers, hospital, large mercantile, which would be greater than 50,000 square feet, and high-rise structures. And this slide here, hopefully, will kind of bring it all together for you in terms of the high-risk business, some examples, our current service levels, as well as future service levels. In a high-risk business, a couple examples, Boeing, TRW, and hospitals. Currently in our community, we have 2,000 of those. Under our current fire prevention service level, we inspect 1,000 of those annually, so about half of them. Under the model we're going to propose here, we would be inspecting all 2,000 of those high-risk business on an annual basis. Let's move now to medium-risk businesses. Again, definition, because council requested it, just to show you that we've got that. I've broken it down for presentation purposes in terms of what that means. And really, it falls in the same lines as high-risk. It's going to be based on the type of business there, the materials stored and used at that facility, the quantity of materials on site, processes. And then just a few examples, assemblies not classified as high risk, educational facilities would fall in this category, hotels, apartments, and businesses between the 12 and 50,000 square foot level. Again, this slide was designed to bring medium risk businesses, what our current service level is and what the proposed service level would be. We currently have 3,000 of these businesses in our community. Under our current model, our current fire prevention service level, we're inspecting only 600 of those annually. Under the model we're going to present, we would be inspecting 1,500 of those annually, which means within a two-year period, all 3,000 of those medium-risk businesses would be inspected by our Fire Prevention Bureau. Low risk, again, a definition because you asked for it. And just some examples there, convenience stores, self-serve storage units, banks, car washes, mercantile businesses that are less than 12,000 square feet. And again, a slide to kind of bring our service, current and future service levels as it relates to low-risk businesses to you. Some examples, Hallmark card shops, Subways. Currently, we have 9,000 of these businesses in our community. And under our existing service levels, we have contact with 4,500 of those annually. And again, if you look at that, that slide has changed from inspections to contacts because we do not inspect these businesses. We do have contact with them through a program called our Partners in Preventions, which basically was our engine companies going out in the field and handing the business a self-inspection form, taking a quick look at the business, and then moving on. Under our proposed model, we would actually be making contact with those businesses, all 9,000 of them annually, and that would be through a mail-out program. And again, they would be getting the self-inspection, and we'll talk about that a little bit as well. So in order to do that, again, the direction we were given was to come up with a full cost recovery model that would cover just expanding services. And the proposal we'd like to present to you is, number one, be a fire safety operational permit fee. I've got a slide that will kind of break this down further. But what we're proposing is a $15 annual fee that all businesses in the city of Mesa would pay. Again, 14,000 of those, which would generate $210,000 annually. The second one we're recommending is a high-risk inspection fee of $250 for those businesses that fall into that category. We have 2,000 of those, would generate $500,000 annually. An additional fee for high-risk facilities that are 12,000 square feet or greater. And we estimate we've got about 750 of those in our community, generating $150,000 a year. We're also recommending a medium-risk inspection fee of $150. Again, we've got 3,000 of those in our community, but we would only be inspecting half of those annually, all of them within a two-year period, so that would generate $225,000. They're also recommending a follow-up inspection fee. This would be a fee that would be imposed if we have to go back to the business a third time, because we went to an inspection, asked them to make some corrections. They did not, and we had to go back and make those corrections. Again, that does not really generate a whole lot of money, but it's really a good way to do business and kind of gives our inspectors a little bit more enforcement power and will hopefully save time in terms of their inspection load. Total estimated revenue is $1,120,000, which, as you see, will cover the full cost recovery of expanding our services. This chart here was some changes that were made from the fire committee. The fire committee and basically their approach that they took was that they wanted the high-risk occupancies to carry a little bit more of the load. So there were some adjustments. Originally, we had this at 200. It's now up at 250, which actually dropped the fire safety operational permit fee down from our original proposal of 30 to 15. Let's talk about the fire safety operational permit fee a little bit. This is a fee, again, that's paid annually by every business in Mesa, excluding home-based businesses. As a result of that, what they get, they will have their emergency contact information updated. That information will be entered into our Mesa, our dispatch system. We'll confirm the type of business that's being conducted at the site, and this is really critical because, as we know, some businesses or subway shop moves in, moves out, somebody moves in, and now is storing hazardous material. So we'll be able to keep up on that a little bit better. They'll receive a self-inspection form that they can fill out and mail back to the Fire Prevention Bureau. In return, we will send them a certificate to hang in their business. And the business will receive other important safety information. This program here seems very simple. It's a very nominal fee. It seems very simple. But the benefits to our community are great. The first responders, we use that emergency contact information literally daily. And I think it's a great benefit to the businesses as well, because I think everybody who owns a business would like to be contacted if there's an event at their business. Currently, we don't have active current information for those businesses. So I think it's a win situation for the city. It's also a win situation for the business itself. Put this slide together because one of the things we're always concerned about is Mesa a business-friendly community? So we wanted to compare in terms of what it's going to cost to operate in the city of Mesa compared to our neighboring jurisdictions. We broke it down into high, medium, and low. And again, I think it's important to note that there's not a community that has a full cost recovery model in place. And every community charges for fire prevention services, but everybody does it differently. So what we have here in Phoenix for a high-risk business, it's going to, the minimum fee they're going to charge them is going to be $400. And then probably on an average, it's going to be between $400 and $1,650. And then it goes up a lot higher than that, but as an average, that's what it is. In Tempe, they have an initial fee only of $100 to $500, and in Chandler, it's an annual fee of about $500 for a high-risk business. Compared to what we're proposing in Mesa, if this is implemented, it would be $280 or $480 if it was a high-risk business that was a large facility. Again, still lower than neighboring communities. Medium risk in Phoenix, between $400 and $800. In Tempe, again, only an initial fee of $100 to $500. In Chandler, it would be $300 for medium risk. And then City of Mesa, it would be $180. And those fees you're seeing there are the inspection fee along with the fire safety operational permit fee. So it would be for the medium, $150 plus the third. That's actually off because it should be $15. Low-risk businesses is $50 and $70 in Phoenix, Tempe. $45 to $70, Chandler $40, and what we're proposing is $15 in Mesa. I need to explain that, though. That none of the other neighboring jurisdictions have an actual permit fee for fire prevention services. We put that in there. What that is an annual business fee that businesses pay in those neighboring communities. We put that in there to show that businesses are used to paying an annual fee in the communities in which they function. It's a business license. We do not have a business license in the city of Mesa. So the $15 fee they pay on an annual basis, most businesses are used to paying some type of fee, and it's still lower than they would be paying with an annual business fee in neighboring communities. Just a couple items that we put in here because some feedback that we received from previous discussions with council. There was some discussion about waiving the fees for businesses that are sprinkled. We looked at that. We felt that a fire sprinkler system is really a basic life safety feature in a business. So we didn't want to give breaks to all the communities that or all the businesses that put them in place. What we would like to explore, though, is maybe waiving the fees for businesses that put sprinkler systems in and maintain those sprinkler systems when they don't have to. Now, the reality is there's not that many of those businesses in our community, and there probably won't be in the future, but we will give them a little bit of a perk there if they do that. Also, some discussions that took place with council was the billing process. They were concerned that you're going to get multiple billings throughout the year and did not want that to happen. And as we've refined the process, businesses will receive only one bill annually. They will get their fire safety operational permit fee along with their inspection fee once a year. The only additional bill they will get would be a bill if, by some chance, the inspector goes out and they have to follow up that third, fourth, fifth time, and we have to impose that additional $50 inspection fee. Next steps, again, fire committee directed us to come to council. We're looking for direction from council. What we'd like to do is start sending out educational letters to the businesses. We do not want the business, the first time they hear about this program is when they receive a bill from the fire department. We would like to send out letters. We would like to provide them opportunities to come speak to us. And we would like to start that as soon as possible, as soon as we get direction from council to move forward with this model. Involve the media, if we need to get the word out to our businesses. Hold stakeholders meetings. Again, open it up and then send letters out to businesses and say, the fire prevention staff is going to become available at this time. We will give a presentation on this program, and you can ask us any questions that you would like. And then our goal, may be a little aggressive, but is implement in March of 2007. Because of logistics in terms of hiring and the pool of people that are available out there, it'll probably be a two-phase implementation. Well, first phase we'd like to start in March. Probably the final phase would probably be June, July. And that covers the model that we'd like to present to you, and at this time, be more than happy to answer any questions you may have.
Councilmember Griswold, you are the chair of the fire committee. Would you like to kick this off?
Sure. You know, I don't like business fees. Being a small business person, for the pay a fee every year for the privilege of collecting sales tax for Mesa doesn't excite me a lot, but I don't mind paying a fee for something I get. And to have the fire department call me on my cell phone if my building was on fire, I don't have a problem with that at all, and to work with me, et cetera. So I'm not anti the $15 if I get something for the paying the fee. And I also believe that we should inspect our high-risk ones every year. We owe that to the residents, we owe that to the neighbors, we owe that to the businesses. And so as far as we've been behind on inspections, I think this is a great way to catch up. People using the services pay for it. So, you know, and people say, low risk, you know, what does it matter if a subway or whatever comes in there? People forget when a nail studio goes in where there used to be a subway, they have acetone stored in the back, which makes a real flammable mess when it goes off. I just saw down on Mesa that one of our local gun and ammo stores being placed by a payday loan. If it goes the other way, you probably want to know about what you're going in that little strip mall and fighting when it goes off. So, anyway, I'll be in favor of this. I think it's a good approach.
A payday loan store in Mesa? This is shocking. Councilmember Rawls.
Do we really want to revisit that?
I'm not allowed to. I was on the losing side of that vote.
I commend the fire department and the personnel for coming up with this initial program and the modifications you've made. I'm really glad that my math checked out, by the way. I was very concerned. I was concerned about that as I was doing the math on the fly. And one of the reasons that just for the council's edification, if you haven't had a chance to read the report, the minutes, is I felt that the initial fee for everyone was a little too high, and I preferred to have the high-risk businesses and the medium-risk businesses pay a greater share of their inspection fees. So I'm really happy that the numbers work out. I think the $15 fee can be justified for everyone, as much as, like Rex, I dislike business fees. You do get updated information. You do get the fire department, the safety personnel, get the information that they need to know whether or not it's changed category. I think there's also a general benefit to the entire business community to know that the place next door is being inspected. It might be a different kind of business, and it might have a medium risk. And if you're right next to it in a strip mall, so there's value for the $15. I question it at 30, but I think at 15 it can be justified. So I think this could be a model for the country. I like the idea. I think that we're being innovative and we're not going out and raising fees just to collect money, but we're providing a very specific, a very worthwhile, a very important public safety function and service in exchange. So I think this is exciting. I'm looking forward to see how it rolls out and see how it's received by the community at large. Oh, I had one other question, though. Is the reinspection, the initial reinspection, not involve a $50 fee?
That's correct.
It's only the third time.
That's correct.
I think that's perfect, too. That way you can, the second time you go out, or when you leave the first time, you say, you know, if I have to come back again and I find everything that's okay, you don't have to pay anymore. But if I have to come back a third time, you're going to start paying. I think that's good leverage. So good job. I'm very happy with it.
Councilmember Jones, should we hear from the other member of the fire committee?
I don't think there's really a need to. We had good discussion then. They made adjustments, and I'm very pleased with the outcome.
Councilmember Whalen.
Thank you. Does this require an ordinance?
I think they're requesting, to set the fees, it depends on do you have fees at this point or these new fees you're establishing?
We have what we were planning on doing was coming back with a resolution for the fees. We have in an ordinance that we have the ability to accept permit fees. So
that's fine. As long as it's not already established in an ordinance, you can revise or establish them in a resolution. Once they're placed in ordinance, they can only be amended or modified through an ordinance.
Okay. Will the fire department be doing the invoicing in-house, or and what would you do if there's someone does not pay?
We will. We've worked with finance and accounting. Our new firehouse program that we recently implemented in the fire department has the ability to do invoicing. So we will be sending out the invoices. If we do not get paid, we will be sending the 30, 60, 90-day notices out. The money itself will be going, integrating into the existing city program, in which we will not be receiving money. That will go to accounting and finance.
What if they don't pay?
If they don't pay, inspector for the fire safety operational permit fee, we anticipate that we're going to have to go out and do an inspection. We feel if they don't pay that $15 fee, there's potential that they could be hiding something, so we will send an inspector out.
So we'll do an inspection, and they still don't pay?
Eventually, we have the ability to cite them for
non-compliance. Okay, so there is a follow-up ordinance that we can use.
We have citation rights at this time.
Civil?
They would not be complying with the fire code.
And we don't charge currently an annual business fee. Other cities do. It would seem that might be easier to have city finance take that role on rather than have the fire department have to do it. Have you thought about incorporating that into the business license portion rather than having your personnel having to do it?
Well, the reason that we actually like doing it is because we need that data, and I'm sure there's a way we can have them do it. But we felt if we were managing that, the data is critical to us. We would have ownership of that data. It would get entered and processed into the system a little bit more efficiently.
And there may be an additional way to capture the data through the alarm permit process because that data is already there. It might be a way to incorporate, you know, rather than have the alarm permit people send out an annual notice with a fee, and then the fire department send out an annual notice with a fee, perhaps we could somehow combine those into one. Although they roll, I believe the alarm permit fees go on a month-to-month basis. They go out all year long.
That's the way this would be managed as well.
It might be, rather than create a whole new bureaucracy, it might be something that the systems could work together.
We'll take a look at that.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Councilmember Griswold.
No, I was just going to say that you don't have to fight their fire if they don't pay the fee, but that's probably not a good enforcement.
This is not Gilbert. Okay. Oh, and I avoided the Iraq comment.
Yeah,
I know. Now I'm in trouble. Mayor Berman's going to get mad at me.
On the website.
I'm going to have a bobblehead. I have a couple of questions. First of all, on those who are paying the $15, you know, and they do the, they get the self-inspection form and they fill that out and they send it back in, do you do random checks just to make sure that, you know, you can send me a self-inspection form, I can check it off, I can do it in probably 2 or 3 minutes, send it back in, never move out of my seat and never check to see what's there? So is there some provision in your plan to do just occasional random checks? For instance, you might be out doing a medium a medium hazard occupancy, and you might go to one or two of the others that are around there and just look at them.
Yeah, we currently do not do random checks. We do because we do not do any inspections of low risk. We do inspect them when there's a concern or a complaint filed. We will send an inspector out. As far as random, we just don't have the staff to do that.
Okay, I don't think we should tell people that. I think we should tell them we do random checks.
Like I said, we do random checks.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you, Chief.
Expanding our credibility on a daily basis, right?
I say we didn't.
Councilmember Whalen.
I forgot one additional thing. My experience tells me there may be a lot of fire prevention systems out there that are not functioning. Do your high-risk businesses and medium-risk require that you go through the systems and demonstrate that they are functioning?
We require them to actually have it inspected by a private company. But that's, again, a very good positive in terms of the low-risk businesses, because we will maintain, we do track those systems, and even though we don't inspect them, we do track and make sure that they have, if they do have a system in place, that they've had the appropriate inspection. We do.
You're doing that currently, right? You're sending out the forms now.
Yes.
Or have you not, because of manpower in the last year or so?
We've been trying to, but we've been getting behind significantly.
I'd like you to consider what I was suggesting about the random checks.
Vice Mayor, I was going to add to your comments. In all seriousness, that makes a lot of sense. I don't know that we would have to have a huge amount of staff to do that, but I think it's important that we have some sort of system that holds people accountable, because I think it's fair to the neighbors that we would do something like that. So we'll look into that very seriously.
I would appreciate it, and I think with ramping up the staff, if you are in the neighborhood, it probably doesn't add that much. And if we find out that there is a significant problem, then we might want to revisit that basic fee, because then we might need to do more of that. I have another question, but Councilmember Griswold, go ahead.
I was just going to mention there's also, you've got the third enforcement tool, it's called fire insurance. I know owning a restaurant, you have to have it inspected, your Ansel system and the chemical system, and it has to be done by an outside company. Your fire insurance asks for those certificates. If you don't have them and you have a fire, they don't cover you. So there is a hook from the private industry, too. And also why a lot of people want to join the city now, because we're rated, what, a four ranking, level four for insurance
class
reasons?
Two.
Class two. And the County Islands are a class something.
Ten.
Ten. Tenfold.
Ten is a rank.
It is a rank, but it's, you know, your insurance premiums in a county island are phenomenal compared to what they are in doing a business in the city, because we do have good fire coverage. So there is a huge emphasis to locate in the city, at least from fire insurance part of it.
Another question on the pursuit of people who do not pay fees. I would assume at some point they get tossed into the city system, which then sends them to collections. Is that not also correct? Okay, so there's that. And I just want to make a comment on this concept. You know, people have a tendency to see, you know, we see the downside and things that we've gone through, you know, the economic issues that we've gone through as a city. And I tell people that every time you have a downside, there's usually an upside. And one is that you examine things very, very carefully. The model that we have used for years in financing the city was no longer financing the city. And so people said, okay, now what are you going to do? Well, what we're looking at is a different way of financing the city, maybe than other cities do. And this is one example of that. We started looking at how do we provide this very important safety service, but it's over and above the level of service that the average resident of the community needs, and that is to charge the individuals who are getting that additional service a fee that is commensurate with the cost of that additional service. And so what you've gone here is a cost recovery model that takes into account all of the dangers that are in place out in the community, mitigating those dangers, and assesses a cost based on that. So I really appreciate that. I appreciate the work of the fire committee. It's good work. I think it looks excellent. Do you need a motion now, or where are we, Chief?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, if I may add some comments to your input.
Please.
I think it's important that we understand that what this is really about is improving a service level for fire prevention that's been very inadequate for a long time and becoming more inadequate as the city population increases. The other, I think, important point here is to remind everybody that our typical approach, even though we have code enforcement capabilities, our typical approach is to go out and help the community become safer. So we work very closely with the occupancies and inform them as much as possible and give them as many breaks and as opportunities as we can to have them meet the intent of the safety requirements for the city. So although we are an enforcement agency, I think our goal is to go out and cause this sort of change, not only in the way they do business, but in their individual attitudes in terms of safety. So I would like to reinforce that that is our style, and that if we have a point where we need to take official action, we do have that ability as well. However, that is not our first alternative.
I think you have direction from the council on where to go. You don't need a motion, do you? Okay. Thank you. Thanks for the presentation. Appreciate it. We're moving on now to a presentation on emergency. How's it posted? Here, a presentation on Homeland Security Grant Program.
Vice Mayor, members of the council, as you know, our Emergency Management Division is extremely active, not only within our city, but within our region. And they've been extremely busy. In fact, as you would imagine, it really is a full department worth of responsibilities rolled into a relatively small staff. So there's a tremendous amount of work that goes into this whole process. One of the major challenges for our division is that it's trying to manage the grant processes. As you know, we've been very successful in grants, but there's a lot of work that goes along with making those grants active for us, as well as reporting on them. It's important, I think, to note that most of the grants that we receive obviously come through us from the federal government, passed down through the state, through a series of regional committees that make designations on actually how those funds will be expended. So it's really, even though the City of Mesa receives the grant, we're really all part of a regional plan to do a better job with Homeland Security Emergency Management here in the region. Here with me today are the Emergency Management key staff members, Chief Damiani and Lieutenant Lithgow, provided us a brief update on the grants, but also some changes in the way the Homeland Security grants are being managed, and then some current purchases that we're looking forward to your approval.
Thank you. Good morning, Vice Mayor and Council. One of the things I was telling Chief Beck when I first started in emergency management, my idea of a horror movie would be managing grants, although not very many people would probably appreciate that. You have to actually be in the position, but it has been a learning experience for me. What I'm going to try to do is to kind of give you a 30,000-foot view of what goes on when we acquire grants and that process. If you take a look at these four grants, these are the primary grants that we get, that emergency management deals with, and I've had the pleasure to deal with over the last 10 months or so. If you want to envision the Homeland Security, Federal Homeland Security Bureau as an umbrella, these are the four primary grants that programs that are under that umbrella. And I'm going to get into a little bit of detail with each one of them as we go through the process. The federal strategy basically has, I've summarized what they are. One of the primary objectives is regional collaboration. I attended a conference in Alabama last month, and David Paulson, the FEMA director, was there, and he was very clear in stating that he wants to make sure that as we work together as state or regional entities, we need to plan as a region. We can't just be islands anymore. So the national strategy basically talks about strengthening information sharing and collaboration, strengthening interoperability, strengthening CBRNE detection and response, and strengthening the medical surge and mass prophylaxis. So that's kind of the national strategy as we progress. As we get into the state programs, the way the money comes down from the federal government, this is our state Homeland Security Grant Program. This is a program that anyone in the state can, if they have a project, can apply for a grant. Depending on your region, the state is broken up into five regions. We are in the central region. We call it the CRAC. And advisory councils have been established in each of the five regions to determine, evaluate projects that are going to benefit that particular region and hopefully the state. The regional councils are comprised of a variety of municipal employees, county, elected officials, law enforcement, fire officials, and there are a couple at-large positions. In the central region, there are, I believe, 10 positions. And
coincidentally, the state has just changed from the Governor's Office of Homeland Security to the Arizona Department of Homeland Security, so the council has been disbanded, and they are in the process of forming another one. But it will still be made up of the same components here. As I mentioned before, the projects are evaluated based on their applicability, the regional coordination, how it's going to benefit the region. And one of the projects that we have on the agenda was the SCADA project for utilities. And that's kind of an example of the regional coordination for the Homeland Security grant. The Urban Area Security Initiative is a little different in that the federal government 3 or 4 or 5 years ago established the 25 or 30 largest urban areas that had a threat or either by location or by threat vulnerability established the UASI regions. Phoenix is a UASI city, Mesa is not. But again, in the light of regional collaboration, Phoenix determined that all the neighboring cities were to be part of the region, so that if there were ever an attack or an incident large enough to involve some of the other, or involve Phoenix, the other agencies would be prepared and equipped and trained to respond into the Phoenix area to assist in that endeavor. These are the members of the steering committee, which actually votes on what projects are to be approved and acted on. So you can see here that all the regional partners, all the cities that surround Phoenix, the county, the state, Department of Public Safety, and Department of Health Services, Homeland Security, are also part of that steering committee. The steering committee itself is broken up into 8 subcommittees. So if there is a project that is going to be recommended within the region, it would fall into one of these 8 subcommittees. The RRT-IST is a rapid response team. And as you may remember, we had an incident in Phoenix several months ago, or actually probably in September, where there was a structural collapse. And if you saw any of the video footage or news clippings, you saw that there were several of the rapid response units there from Mesa, Chandler, and Phoenix to assist in removing that trapped construction worker. That was part of that regional response. The prevention committee is another one, and Lieutenant Lithgow is co-chairperson on that, and they predominantly deal with law enforcement issues, site security issues, and things like that. We have a classification committee that talks and discusses when a project comes through, does the equipment that is requested or equipment, does it fall into the guideline that we have approved in the past? So they evaluate all that. And then, of course, you've got the interoperability issue that is always present, and we need to continue to work on that. And then, obviously, the state, local law enforcement agencies, the county, state law enforcement officials always have a say-so in what happens. And then, finally, the training exercise, Citizens Corps, and MMRS are also part of that subcommittee that make determinations on how money will be allocated. The MMRS is a Metropolitan Medical Response System, and this is something that they have identified it used to be 125, one dropped out, so it was 124 cities throughout the nation that have applied for and received grant money that basically help us to prepare for a large-scale disaster. And one of the things, and again, I keep bringing the regional partnerships up because it is significant. We have limited resources within the city of Mesa. Mesa is an MMRS city, Glendale is an MMRS city, Phoenix is an MMRS city, and Tucson is also one. We have given equipment to using grant money with to Gilbert and Tempe to assist us in an effort if, in fact, there were a large-scale incident where we needed equipment and manpower. They would respond to help us out or to help out the region. And again, as I said, these are federal money, so this would be a state and federal asset as well. The Law Enforcement Terrorism Prevention Program, we have gotten some money from that particular grant program. And currently, we have money for interconnecting fiber connectivity with Phoenix. for information sharing. And as we had over the last Monday, we talked about the terrorism liaison officer, and there have been some monies available for the terrorism liaison officer program and some site hardening issues as well, fencing, cameras, and that type of thing. Up to this point, we have received, since 2000, the city of Mesa has received in the neighborhood of, I believe, $12.6 million. And I might add that the money has been largely spent for equipment, apparatus, and I won't say the significant part of the money was spent for training, but in my opinion, it doesn't do us much good to have equipment and apparatus if we don't have training for our first responders to be able to use that equipment that we have. One of the other things that is and I should have mentioned it earlier, when we implement a program or a project within the region, one of the guidelines that we try to follow is something that we can use every day. So it's not something that we put on a shelf, and when the terrorist attack or the significant incident occurs once every 5 years, we take that piece of equipment out and try to use it and not being very familiar with it. The equipment that we've purchased, we try to use on a daily, in our day-to-day business as first responders. And I believe when the disaster hits, and sooner or later it will, that our folks will be prepared to be able to use that equipment adequately. The grant allocations up to this point, as I mentioned, that's how much we've acquired. We've spent about 7.6, and we have about 5.2 remaining. Now, that's not money that's just floating out there. That is money that we have earmarked. It just hasn't been spent yet. It hasn't gone out of our account yet. It is earmarked for, as I said, the command van and a few other projects that haven't been purchased yet. The grants, and I'm sure you're well aware of this, typically come with timelines. The active date of the grants are anywhere from 18 months to 3 years. As a side note, we just closed out the 2003 UASI grant at the end of October. It was extended a couple of different times. So that particular grant expired October 31st. We do have some other deadlines coming up, but so it's not a hard and fast rule as far as the active date of the grant. The state has made a few changes here in the recent past to kind of tighten up the system to make sure that money is moving and projects have been approved before they have been approved before you get money for those projects. Any questions regarding the grants themselves?
Questions about the grants. Councilmember Ross.
The $12.8 million that's referenced in the last slide you had up, that was just for the city of Mesa.
Vice Mayor, Councilmember Ross, that is just within the city of Mesa.
Do you know what the total grants for the region is? And by that, I just Maricopa County and it's the entities inside it?
I do not have that information readily available. We could probably find that for you if you'd like.
I would appreciate that. And the same thing is probably even less likely to have this number. I'd like to know what the number is for the country. Even less likely to have that, right?
I can tell you that the grant numbers, the dollars, I should say, are diminishing. At one point, the region got, and I can't tell you what year it was, we got $42 million. The following year, we got $4.2 million. So, but we can get that information.
And I appreciate that. I wouldn't expect you to have those numbers off the top of your head. When the, and this, on Monday when we had this discussion about the two vehicles, there were times when it sounded like the money had to be used for those vehicles, and then it was like, well, we chose those two vehicles, so now we have to use the money for those vehicles. I never could quite get a clear understanding as to what type of restrictions or strings or whatever that the federal government puts on this money when it comes down to us. Can either one of you answer that?
Yeah, but
it's a broad question to start with.
Yeah, I understand, and I'm sorry for the confusion. That particular money comes from the Urban Area Security Initiatives funds that Chief Damiani talked about. Within the Urban Area Security Initiative, there are those subcommittees, one of them being prevention. Some of the money that was distributed through the steering committee
was for RRT response, the rapid response teams. And then there was also some money that was distributed for prevention projects. Excuse me. The prevention projects are things like site hardening, doing threat and vulnerability assessments, and that is the purpose of that terrorism liaison officer program.
Right.
So the UASI money that came to the prevention committee was tasked with identifying agencies that could provide terrorism liaison officers. MESA was identified as one of those agencies, and that is where the funding came from. And that's why that particular funding was limited to only purchasing the equipment to outfit the terrorism liaison officers.
So, let me take it back up to 30,000 feet then, rather than the 4,000 that you dropped to there. What kind of restrictions or strings are attached to the money from the federal government? Can it be used for personnel?
In very limited cases. In most cases, you can't use it for personnel.
Okay. So it's primarily equipment and training. Would that be a...
Equipment, training, there are some planning allowances. There's some management and administration cost allowances. And I hesitate when you said, can you use it for personnel? Because all of the grants that Chief Damiani mentioned, there's slight differences in all of them.
Right, that's why we went back up to 30,000 feet,
okay.
Because we could spend the rest of the week talking about the nuances of each program.
In general.
Right, okay.
In general, you can.
Right.
When we talk about personnel, the grant typically does not cover full-time employees.
Right.
There are provisions for covering overtime for training and consultants and things like that, but it does not cover, that I've seen, full-time employees.
Well, let's drop that down to 1,000 feet. The two vehicles that we agreed to purchase on Monday, or the council approved, who made the specific decision that to either ask for, who made the decision that that was the best use of that $96,000?
From that funding stream of money,
right.
The steering committee, the Urban Area Security Initiative Steering Committee, okay. Is the governing body for those particular funds. They got together and we as a group said, this is important to us and we think that this is where funds should go. And that was just one of the things that we spent it on, but that was how the decision was.
So this, it would have been the subcommittee of the UASI regional steering committee.
The subcommittee determined which agencies would get that. The steering committee determined that that was
okay.
A priority.
Okay.
And the steering committee is made up of a lot of the different agencies from throughout the region, Mesa, Phoenix, Chandler, Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, all of those
right.
Regional agencies.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Jones.
And Gil, your statement earlier about getting involved with grant writing being a nightmare, In my exposure with other elected officials when I go to National League of Cities and so forth and talking about grant writing, it becomes an art, really, to win those funds. So what you have is an organization somewhere or an entity that is providing money and they have general guidelines of what they want that money to go for. Then those who are competing for the grants, you have to have somebody who sells what you're going to do, and you write out a full report saying, this is how we propose to use this money. If you select us to receive this grant, here's how we're going to do it. So once you submit that and you are awarded that grant, you have to use it the way you spelled it out when you submitted for that grant. And that, in that regard, your hands are very tight, because if you don't use it that way, you don't get the grant.
Vice Mayor, Councilmember Jones, you're absolutely correct. For competitive grants, that's the way that works. These particular grants,
right.
Up until this year, have not been competitive. These have been grants that have been awarded to the region or the state. However, as I mentioned, with the change in the Arizona State Homeland Security Division, the grants will now become competitive, where we have to write the plan and approve. Everything will be approved before any money can be spent.
Right. And again, that was where that grant money came, the Homeland Security. It came down from the feds to a state agency to a regional agency where they said, here's money, here's your guidelines of how it's to be used. You guys in your own region determine how it's to be spent. So you had a steering committee, made a determination, okay, we have this pot of money, it's going to be used for this thing. They went through and they selected the ones that they thought were going to use it.
That is
and
great.
Now it's going to be shifting to a competitive grant like most others are.
That is correct.
Okay.
The way I understand it now, and again, it hasn't been delineated out exactly, but that it's leading towards that, in that direction.
So what it sounds like to me is that that UASI committee is equivalent to MAG. They get together, they make a vote, and then they designated the agencies that were getting it. We were an agency that could get it. We could get it for that, and we couldn't use it for anything else because that's what they decided that money was going to be used for. If we didn't accept it, it would go back into the pot for another city to get it, or who knows. Chris.
And Councilor, I'm really just sure, or Vice Mayor, I'm really sure the council, that's exactly how it was done in Texas. That as much as if even you were on the 25 top cities that were identified as being most vulnerable and had a direct allocation, even the feds had categories in which you could spend the dollars. So you had to be very careful with that. But you also had to do a regional approach. You had to show that you had a regional consideration for the equipment that was being purchased and that the region bought into it. You couldn't just on your own decide this is what's best for us and go buy a certain piece of equipment. Now, certainly we've heard of abuses that have taken place throughout the country, but in general I would say that if you look at the dollars, they are being spent on a regional basis. Now, what's interesting is that, and we'll talk about this in the command vehicle and some of the equipment, is frankly it will be available for the city to use on a regular daily basis. But what it also means is when there is a regional incident, that then that equipment has to be made available to go respond. So we're then part of this larger region. So while we benefit from it on a daily basis when there is a regional incident, then that regional equipment then gets pulled in as a response, and that's kind of the way that I think the federal government, that's why they've set it up to these regions. But we do at some point have very limited in what we can do. Now, no doubt we make a proposal to the region about how we think our pieces of equipment or whatever we're asking will fit into their plan. But ultimately, everything you see here has to be approved by a regional group.
Thank you. That was a good segue into our next piece, which is the command vehicle presentation. Just a reminder for all of us, we do have an executive session study scheduled after this, so we have to go into special council meeting. So we're going to keep moving forward here.
I'm going to let Lieutenant Lithgow cover the command vehicle since he was a major player in the design and processing of this document.
I have some hard copies of the schematics of the proposed vehicle, so I'm just going to hand that around. We also have a larger representation of the vehicle, and I'm not sure if we want to bring that out. I'm not sure where it would be appropriate to put it. The larger representation we have here on this billboard is some of the same diagrams that you're going to have in front of you there, but in case you'd like to see that also. As Chief Damiani said, the background on this vehicle is that the Urban Area Security Initiative, the steering committee, got together and they created a strategy. The original strategy was created in 2003, and that's an evolving document on a year-to-year basis that's looked at over again and reevaluated to see if that's still the direction we want to go. But one of the primary things that we've looked at with the steering committee is to create rapid response teams. There are rapid response teams that are throughout the region, and MESA is responsible for maintaining two of those rapid response teams. The rapid response team consists of a fire component and a police component. And in a real serious situation, a real serious emergency, it would most likely require both the police and fire department to respond to that incident. When the rapid response team responds, because we have two rapid response teams, we're responsible for maintaining two, we need to have the ability to go to two separate locations. We would not want to deplete all our resources here in the city of Mesa, so we would want to have the capability to have one of those teams here, even if one had to go to another area of the region. The idea behind it is that if we have a major incident, most likely we're going to need help from other agencies. And likewise, if another agency in the Valley has a major incident, they're going to need help from us. And that's the idea behind the rapid response teams. We looked at our needs for the rapid response team, and one of the things that we identified as a need was a command vehicle that would help us coordinate our response. The other thing that we have noticed a need for is some type of interoperable communication solution. We have the 800 megahertz, and that goes a long way to the interoperable communication solution, but not everybody in the Valley is in that system right now. And so we wanted to identify a way to work through that issue. We took the idea of a command vehicle for the City Mesa before the steering committee, and that was approved. I also should mention that the command vehicle that we currently have is about 10 years old, and it has worked well for us, but it also seems to make sense that it would be a good idea to stagger the purchases, being that they're major purchases, instead of needing them all at one time. When we were putting the project together, we created a group, a committee, that was made up of members from Fleet Support Services, the police department, members from the radio shop, technicians there, and somebody from police systems, so we could evaluate what we needed, and that's how we came up with the specifications for the vehicle. This same group was used to assist with the selection process. With the help of purchasing, we sent this proposal out for bid, and we came back with three vendors, and they're listed here: Frontline Communications, LDV Incorporated, and MBF Industries. The asterisk there is just letting you know that the price that you're seeing there is not the same as the price that you have in the council report, because it doesn't reflect the warranty costs or the tax. But when we were looking at price during this proposal process, those were the prices that we were looking at. That proposal process was done through a scoring mechanism that was put together with the help of the purchasing department. And after looking at all of the proposals, we were recommending that the manufacturer be MBF Industries. The vehicle that we're looking at would have a conference room that would have a large table, eight chairs, and a workstation inside in the conference room. The workstation would also have a computer, a telephone, a printer. There will be a dry erase board and another electronic dry erase board that's tied to the computer in the conference room, so that notes can be taken and actually digitally recorded on the computer if necessary. In the second section, there will be a command center. And in the command center, there will be five separate workstations. These workstations will have computers, monitors, telephones, individual radios for each station, so that in the event of emergency, we can have staff at all those stations. And then in the very end, there's a galley lavatory area so that you have that when you're on an incident. There are also some monitors in the front portion of the vehicle in the conference room area that would allow us to look at a camera, a mast-mounted camera that we're going to have on top of the vehicle, and also let us look at news broadcasts, either nationally or locally. The interoperable communication solution that we were looking at is the ACU 1000. This is a device that's commonly used for interoperable communications. And what this will allow us to do is expand up to 11 different communications devices. What we will be doing is we'll have it set up with two 800 megahertz radios like we have here, two UHF radios, and two VHF radios. It will also have the ability to plug into a telephone in case you needed to use a telephone on that system also. And then it can go up to 11 different devices. So we have the ability to mix and match devices. There will be a TrackStar satellite dish that will be for the purposes of receiving and transmitting data if that becomes necessary. And then there will be a digital satellite receiver, and that would allow us to have access to national broadcasts in the event of emergency. On the outside, there will also be a workstation. That workstation will consist of a large monitor that will allow us to view the mast-mounted camera, and it will allow us to watch news broadcasts if that's necessary. Some of the uses for that would be to have, if you have a public information officer that is on a scene, they could use that to monitor what's going on in the media if it's too crowded inside the vehicle. We could also conduct briefings with the mast-mounted camera that we're going to have. It would allow us to look at a scene from further away and discuss how you would approach it and that type of thing. There will also be, in addition to the mast-mounted camera that will have day and night capabilities, there will also be another mast that will have lighting capability that will allow us to light a scene in a large area. And those are the features of the vehicle. And if there's any questions I can answer, here I am.
Councilmember Griswold.
I toured a similar vehicle a couple of years ago in the Burnaby, Vancouver area, looking at how they used it, and it was, they got some good use out of it. And I forgot how much coordination it takes on a large, if Tonto National Forest is burning towards Mesa, what you'd need to do to strategize to how do you stop something incoming or a high school hostage situation. So it sounds like expensive, and it, you know, at first I went in there saying, what frills? And then when I came out of the van touring and looked how they used it, I went, I wonder why we don't have one. So now I know.
Councilmember Whelan.
Tony, how many of these for the region?
I don't have an exact number for the region. I know that Glendale had purchased one for previous years. Theirs is not exactly the same as this. Theirs is a larger scale vehicle that would require some time to set up. The idea behind this one was that we'd be able to get in it and drive it to a scene and have it activated relatively soon. I don't have the answer exactly how many there are.
At our last crime fair out east, I think Gilbert had a new one. Is that also funded through this program?
Yes, you're right. Gilbert did purchase one. I'm not sure if it was through UASI, but I'm certain it was through Homeland Security Grant funds.
About 30 feet long? Is that about?
It is
close?
Actually
27, 28?
40.
Is it 40?
45.
Close to 45.
And what type of vehicle is it?
It's a Freightliner.
Diesel, gas?
It's a diesel.
If you've got a need for cell, the capability for private vendor cell towers to come to the vehicle and hook up, or is that a totally separate situation?
We have the specifications that we wrote for the vehicle were that we would have cell phones available to it, but we would also have ability to plug a hardline telephone into the vehicle if we needed. The other option that we could look at is with the satellite system, there are IP telephone systems that would allow you to use the telephone that way. We haven't researched that real thoroughly, though.
Okay. And no limitations on the use of the vehicle? It can be used for police, fire, for any command scene? The only thing that is required, if there's a regional incident, it's got to go to the regional incident.
Right. We should be able to use this on a daily basis when we have emergencies. And when we designed it so that in an emergency, in a major incident, we would be able to use it. But we also designed it so that it would be useful for our day-to-day uses also.
And then our existing command van, we'll keep that as a secondary?
That's correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Councilmember Rawls.
How will you use it on a day-to-day basis?
When I say day-to-day basis, it's likely not every day. But, for example, it's very common for us to go out with the police department on a major scene. And what happens on those major scenes is often we will call the command van, the current van, command van that we have right now. We'll have that come out to the scene. And we'll use that as a command post for a major investigation. Currently, that vehicle does have some space limitations, and it gets pretty tight in there. But the other issue that we run into with using that vehicle is that the fire department really likes to dispatch that vehicle when they have major incidents also. It's automatically dispatched in, help me out, is it first alarm events? When there's a first alarm event, they're going to dispatch that vehicle. We've had some situations where we've been using it for an event, and then they've had a fire and they've needed it. And we've had to decide where the resource is going to go.
How many times has that the existing command vehicle been dispatched this year for fire? I mean, let's just say the last 12 months.
I'm not sure if we have that information.
It would be for each first alarm?
Yeah.
Probably, what was the time frame you?
Just the last 12 months, just the last year.
Oh, I think it's about 100 times.
Okay, and how many times has the police used it for what you called major scenes?
I don't have a number for you, but I can tell you that every time we have a homicide that I know of, we pretty much always bring that out. And that is where we conduct our briefings initially, and that's where we operate out of. In most cases, when we have a major incident like that, that's when we would use it.
And would you anticipate rolling out this new vehicle for homicides?
I think that it would be very likely that we would have that come out on that type of an event.
It's very critical, as Gil mentioned earlier, that whatever equipment you're going to use in a major disaster that you incorporate into your day-to-day operation so that your familiarity with the unit is such that when you have the big one, if you will, right, you can press it into service seamlessly.
Well, I know that was my point. I mean, the chief indicated that, and used his words, he says, we want to buy something we can use every day. And I have a difficult time understanding how something this big and this expensive is going to be used every day.
I think it has more to do with availability and upkeep. It's something that unless you incorporate it into your day-to-day plan, if you will, you may not actually deploy it. But if it's not part of your day-to-day plan, then it sits on the shelf, and when you need it, it's not ready to go.
How many homicides have we had in the last 12 months?
I'm sorry, I don't have that figure.
Ballpark figure? Are we in the 150 range or 30 or 6 figure?
Chief is coming up.
I know.
I believe we have 34 homicides.
Okay. Can you explain to me any other police incidences that would constitute a major scene other than this, the big one, which we all hope doesn't happen, that have occasioned the use of the existing vehicle in the last year?
Although I can't, you know, I can't speak for all the activities that occurred last year. Obviously, I was not
right
here. But the reality is that this type of equipment can be used very, very often. It's not only in a homicide scene, but you have a special event. You may also have training that we have to conduct on a regular basis that we're not conducting today. One of the things that Chief Beck and I have met and discussed is the fact that we believe that we're really not very well prepared if we had a major incident in the city today because we have not been training. And training has to go beyond tabletops. We actually have to put people out there. I think you're aware of it, that the police department, the school district, and the fire department just recently engaged in a grant that is being given to the school districts to be able to provide for the emergency preparedness, which will include the development of plans and access, web-based access to all the school facilities so that first responders, in case of an emergency, can get there and be able to very quickly deal with whatever the situation at hand is. And by the way, the likelihood in this region that a problem in the schools will occur is significant, and more than likely, quite frankly, it's not going to be the big terrorist event. It's going to be an active shooter, and it's going to be a police incident. All we have to do is look around the country and see the increase in this type of activity. So there are actually many incidents where this type of vehicle will become very useful to both the police and fire department, not only in Mesa, but in the area. And one of the things is that we have to start training more aggressively to prepare, and that vehicle will be very helpful in doing so. Just the area interoperability itself, although we're going to be coming to you probably in the near future trying to work some additional agreements with Phoenix and other parts of the region, today we had a problem. We had serial killer that was going around this area here. When the Phoenix Police Department came into Mesa, we were unable to communicate. Our radios were not interoperable. This type of vehicle would help pass some of that because we could just throw in one of their radios and one of our radios and have the ability to communicate. There are just many, many occasions where this type of equipment would be very useful.
And Chief, unwittingly, you just made the point that I want to make, and it's not that this truck is, or
I'm not even sure truck is the right word here for something this big and elaborate, but that this vehicle is not useful and not even perhaps needed for the fires, the class one or whatever word you use, first alarms, or for homicides, or for meth labs, or for the other kind of incidences, the major events that you've described. But none of those have anything to do with Homeland Security. What you just described are local incidences of fires and crime, and I'm just deeply offended by the fact that the political pimps, I started to use the word whores, but they're not offering their own goods and services, but the political pimps in Washington, in the name of trying to make us safe from Homeland Security, are basically funneling plain Santa Claus with all this money that gets funneled down to the local level to be used for things that aren't connected with the war on terror or general Homeland Security. Now, I'm not suggesting that a murder doesn't affect some people's security, but that's not what the Department of Homeland Security in Washington is designed for. So I'm, again, offended by the fact that in the name of making us safe, Congress is giving us money with which to buy not toys, but valuable assets for purposes almost, not entirely, but almost disconnected from their source and their purpose. So that's why I have trouble with this. It's not the two vehicles that we purchased on Monday, and it's not this $850,000 vehicle we'll probably be purchased next Monday. It's that it's just a barefaced lie that 99.9% of the time this vehicle is going to make us safer, which is the purpose of Homeland Security grants, in my view. Now, maybe I'm just wrong as rain, and so be it. But I just have a real problem with what we're buying in the name of Homeland Security, because it's not aimed at that. It's not designed at. I understand on the one major event when it gets sent across the border, on a fine, good enough. But I think the one vehicle we have can do that. So I can't go along with this. If you want to make us safer, quit having us be policemen in a civil war in a country 10,000 miles away. You know, right now what we're doing is motivating and inspiring all new generations of terrorists. Let's stop that. We may not need this.
Well, I'll vote for you for Congress, Tom.
All right, I'll keep that in
mind. Okay. Because I think, you know, I don't disagree with everything you said. I do disagree with a couple of points. I think that this is important for us to have this everyday training, that the notion that Homeland Security starts to me with hometown security, and if we don't have our police and fire officers trained to work together on the everyday stuff, there is, and I don't want to, I need to be careful because I'm not trying to refer to a homicide as an everyday event. Hopefully you don't have to take it out in Mesa. We don't want you to have to take it out in Mesa. But if we don't have the training on the events that occur here on a regular basis, then we aren't going to be able to do the things that occur, hopefully never. For years and years and years, my family has kept a supply of food, and we have a 72-hour emergency kit. My hope is that we will never have to use it, because the preparation is the important part. Hopefully, we won't ever have to use that preparation. Hopefully, we will have so many networks in place of good citizens who tell us, you know, that there's a meth house in their neighborhood and we can respond to that, or that there's terrorist activity going on so that we can stop it before it actually hits and we don't have the incident, we prevent it. That would be the best thing. But the worst thing for me is that we have the incident and we didn't do anything to prepare. So I see all of this as preparing for something that we hope never happens. I appreciate the comments that you made. I think that we all have frustrations with things that are going on, but I think that this is the appropriate use for us in Mesa of this. Now, I do have another question, and that is the life cycle. This will give you two vehicles. The one is currently 10 years old. What is the anticipated time for that vehicle, and what's the anticipated lifespan for this vehicle?
Vice Mayor, members of the council, what we know when we manage major emergencies is that coordination between agencies is the most critical. What we find is, especially from a regional perspective, is that if we don't have the ability to essentially set up what we call a command village, where we can get all the right players in whatever foray of vehicles and equipment that they need to function in the same area, that we're not going to be able to coordinate our resources, because each agency has vast resources that need to be coordinated through their central control. One of the things that we're looking at, for some of the reasons that Tony mentioned earlier, is we would like to be able to retain the old command van as a surplus unit and as well use it on a daily basis within fire as a command unit. At some point in the future, we would have to make a decision as whether or not this was an adequate strategy that we would want to replace that unit or not. But I think right now, if you look at the regional nature, especially in the fire service, when I mentioned 100 first alarms, I'm really talking more of a regional response because of the automatic aid system, although Gilbert has a unit as well. So when we look at the Homeland Security initiatives and we look at the general direction, what we're trying to do is develop regional systems. So what our plan is at this point is to attempt to retain that unit.
I agree with that plan. I think that should be the plan. But my question is, when you purchase this, if we vote to do this tonight, on Monday night, how many years do you anticipate that we will get of service out of that vehicle?
The specification that we asked for when we spec this out and sent that out was that we wanted them to build it with the idea that we would be able to use it for 20 years.
Okay.
Now, whether or not we will be able to actually use it for 20 years because of technology and other issues, I'm not sure, but that was the specification that we had put together.
Just in my experience, coming from L.A., we actually have vehicles that are over 20 years old, and sometimes they need some refurbishing. But generally speaking, you don't put a lot of miles in those vehicles, and so the wear and tear is more of the interior type stuff and then the equipment updates. So this vehicle lasts for a very, very long time.
And that's what we want to see happen. We want it to last for a very long time. I think that's important. You raised another issue, Chief, that I'd like for at least the police committee to hear back on. We should have been able to communicate with Phoenix. We're all on 800 megahertz. I don't know if that was MCSO, which we've had a problem with MCSO forever. If that's what it was, I understand it. If not, I'm hoping that Mr. Whalen, the chair of the police committee, will look into that.
Yeah, there is a problem because the system that Phoenix has today is outstripped by the demand. As a matter of fact, I just talked to Jack Harris, Chief of Police of Phoenix, yesterday. He called me because there's a need for us to engage in some additional activity to upgrade the system in order for all of us to be able to communicate. Actually, Mesa has a very good system. The problem is not Mesa. The problem is some of the other cities in the area. And in order for us to be able to all be able to work together, we're going to have to do some additional work with that system, and as a matter of fact, that is something that we're going to be coming to you very, very shortly with some possible solutions. So, you know, it's not that we failed to plan. I think Mesa did a very good job in planning. I think that other people initially didn't do the things that needed to occur, and now that is manifesting itself in the inability to work together very well radio-wise until we add some technological fixes to it.
And Mr. Whalen, your committee will follow up on that.
Yes.
Thank you.
I can make a couple of comments.
Please, go ahead.
Having had to throw a map on the hood of a police car at a command scene in years past, Tom, the fact that you've got a command vehicle on the street every day is so much different than it used to be. Just the lighting capability alone to light up a scene at night to where you can investigate. So having... This city built the first command van, I think, probably in the early 80s, and we had to scrape together $300,000 or $400,000. I think you're always complaining that the federal government doesn't give us the resources. I think this is one time that in the Homeland Security arena, we are getting some of those resources back that can help. You know, as a plane flies over this city about every 15 seconds, one of them comes down, we're going to need all the resources we can do. It's not just homeland security, its incident management, and its crisis management. So I think anything we can do to be better prepared and better trained is worthwhile for the community and the region. I'm concerned with the amount of. I think every city in the country looks at how the homeland security dollars are vetted, and you know, every time you see Chertoff talk, he's arguing with some city about whether they got their share. So I would not want to send a message to the federal government that we don't want this these materials, because there's about 10 cities standing in line or 100 cities standing in line trying to get the things that they get. And I agree with the chief that this region is very, very critical to look at major incident. I think we could face a major incident as fast as we could. And it's just kind of interesting to think about. I think it was South Dakota that did a major incident training several days before a major airplane came down, and they were at least prepared for that. And I hope that we continue to take that tact. And as long as I'm chair of the committee, I will support you and try to get you moving in that direction.
Yeah, I'll probably disagree with Councilmember Rawls, but sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But when we were attacked in 9/11, I don't think we were in Iraq or Afghanistan. One of the pilots there had his flight physical in Mesa, you know, just before there. Our police, one of the problems with that reaction there, the police and the fire department couldn't talk to each other. They couldn't hear down in basements. They couldn't see national news and know what the big picture was going on. So those are all things you need to take care of. We just had a training exercise at one of the schools on similar to a bird flu epidemic that we had to inoculate several thousand or a couple thousand people, and we found out that we still couldn't talk to the school district on their radios and things like this. We need to practice. We need to be prepared. We need to have the equipment. I think it's all part of homeland security. Is there a lot of waste? I agree. Are there things that you sort of wonder, some of these grants, who wrote them? And why do we have to go through the hoops to get, you know, whatever we're getting, and we could use the money better? Probably because they don't trust people to just give them money and say, spend it as you see fit. You end up with these grants that you have to go through hoops on. So I'll be in favor. I understand it's a huge expense. As long as you use it wisely. I watched the meth lab bust last night with robots. They had, you know, bombs in there. We had the sheriff's office. We had police. And it was a communication challenge going on. So, and it was in a nice neighborhood, too. So I'll be in favor.
Her district.
My district, yeah. It was right near the border of our two districts. Wow, that's two in my – the serial shooters were in my district, too. Council Member Rawls.
Let me see if I can make myself clear. I'm all for incident management. I'm all for crisis management. I'm all for full and extensive training. I'm all for having appropriately sized command vehicles. I think there might be somewhere between something in between a map on the hood of a car and a $800,000 vehicle like this, and maybe 700, maybe 600. It seems to me that also I'm all for this interoperable emergency communications, and I think this $800,000 that we're spending on this one vehicle, particularly since Gilbert has one, I'm probably sure that Phoenix has one, and we now know that Glendale has one, that $800,000 might be better served making sure that the public safety agencies in this community can talk to each other in a crisis rather than having a vehicle. But that's not my problem. My problem is truth in lending, truth in government. And I just think we are participating in a fraud, and I just don't like doing that. So, and I'll, you know, if I ever run for Congress, Claudia, I'll have you as my chairman so that you.
I'll do it.
All right.
I'll do it. I don't agree with you on this one, but I appreciate your position.
Well, I guess the point is that it's very difficult as a local community to say no. I understand that. But I think it is important at times for the local communities to say to the people upstairs, we really don't appreciate the way you're doing it. If you think we need command vehicles for our 100 fires and our 50 homicides or 30 or 20 or hopefully only 5, give us the resources for that. Give us our tax money back for that. Don't give it back to us wrapped in this flag of the war on terror. That's my basis, and I'm sorry that you guys have to listen to that occasionally, but it's good for you.
Hey, we appreciate it. And besides, since this isn't Massachusetts, you don't even have to apologize or anything. You're good. Thank you for taking the time today to visit with us about this issue, and we'll look forward to seeing us on Monday.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Just to confirm, I do want item 6A off the consent.
It is off the consent, and it will stay off the consent agenda. We're moving on now to item 4, which is acknowledging the receipt of meetings, minutes of various boards and committees. We have a motion. We have a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Moving on to hearing reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Can I move this to the Monday meeting? Thank you very much. We'll skip that one. Moving on to scheduling of meetings and general information. We'll see you Monday, and you can tell us then. Do we have any? We don't have any pre-scheduled public. Do we have any speakers?
We do not, Vice Mayor.
All right, then I'll accept a motion for adjournment from this meeting. Do I have a second?
Yes.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And now we are convening a special council meeting for the purposes of going into executive session.
Motion to go to executive session.
And before we vote on that, let me make the point publicly that I still have a conflict on the wave yard issue. I saw that there seems to be something about that on the executive study, executive session agenda. So just so everyone knows, I will not be participating in that or discussing on it since a family member has a business that would be in competition. Therefore, I will turn that part of the meeting over to Councilmember Whalen to conduct that. So for purposes of full disclosure, would you please vote now to go into executive session? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.